I'm Abby Spilka, and I'm a bereavement counselor for Calvary Hospital.
Abby, I'm so glad I could talk to you today because we're fast approaching 9/11, the 20th anniversary of 9/11, and it almost seems like it's going to be tougher this year than usual.
I think you're right, Pat, and I think the 20th anniversary represents the terrible events that happened on one particular day that, frankly, were done in 2 hours as if it were a television show. And with the pandemic, this has been ongoing trauma that has lasted for months and months and months. And as you know, people haven't had a chance to really grieve the people who've died. Funerals couldn't take place. Everything had to happen over Zoom. Even cremation took longer because there was such a backlog. So I think that people are just carrying the weight of what's happened over these past 18 months, not to mention the terrible floods and the fires on the West Coast. There has just been so much trauma. There's a wonderful psychologist in Portland, Oregon, Dr. Robert Niemeyer, who at a conference I attended referred to the tsunami of bereavement. And that was in April. And here we are.
Making matters worse also in the mix is Afghanistan.
Of course.
But it just seems like a lot, like you said, a tsunami. I think part of the problem is that we still don't talk about grief maybe as openly as we should. And you're an expert on grief and loss. And why do you think that is? Is it just American society?
We talk about death and we talk about numbers, but we don't talk about grief. And I was thinking about this from a more philosophical perspective, that you can't spell numbers without numb. And I think that when the numbers get so big, like it's just this amorphous thing. I think that people are afraid of death, whether it's their own death anxiety or their anxiety about other people dying. I think it's the fear of the unknown. I think that everyone understands the birth process, but very few people understand the dying process. And the things that you don't know and don't understand scare you. And I think that until it actually happens to you, you just have no idea what to expect. And I experienced that in so many of my groups where the question is always, is this normal? My clients often ask, am I going crazy? Well, I do my best to explain what the grief experience is like, that it doesn't end after a year, that there are not these linear stages where you go from one thing to another thing, that it is a process. And there are some days you're going to feel not so horrible, and other days you'll feel worse, and other days you'll wake up and say, oh, today feels really different. But it's an ongoing process, and it's a matter of how we integrate that loss into our lives. And you know, with this pandemic, I'm sure you well know, Pat, that we are experiencing non-death related losses as well. Oh. You know, the loss of freedom and security and our health and jobs and relationships. And it's, as I said, it's just so much for human beings to contend with.
Certain cultures, though, seem to be a little more comfortable discussing it. And I'm not really sure what culture this is, but back windows of cars, they'll have a loved one's name, and then it'll almost be like a mini tombstone on the back window of the car. It'll have the date of birth and the date of death and beloved mother. And I've seen a lot of this around where I live.
I haven't seen that, but it's so smart. And I have a feeling there's a wonderful funeral director named Amy Cunningham, who is so creative when it comes to funerals and natural burials. And I know when I was talking with her last year about how funerals were taking place, and she said, well, a lot of times we are having cars drive by the house of the person. And, you know, the last car might have flowers. So with these drive-by funerals, it wouldn't surprise me if that's something that's grown out of the pandemic.
It was a nice tribute and a nice sort of memorial, and it's on the back of the car, and it's sort of like stenciled on there, and sometimes there are flowers stenciled around, and it surprised me because in American culture, we don't normally see something like that. We don't talk about it. What is the difference in the collective grief we suffer from 9/11 versus the pandemic and COVID?
Well, certainly everyone in New York City, and I think much of the nation, but everyone was in mourning and kind of in shock. But I think with COVID and the natural disasters in Afghanistan and the violence, everything is ongoing. But we also know with COVID, there are serious economic and medical differences. So there are some people for whom COVID is an inconvenience. They're working in a different place, but if they don't have other people to take care of, if they're merely inconvenienced, that's one thing. Yeah. While for so many more people, especially in communities of color, there are people who've lost jobs, or who had to keep working as essential workers in environments that are unsafe while juggling childcare and caring for parents or other family members. If you've had a person die and they also got sick, you're contending with sort of the loss of your own ability to breathe the same way, to walk the same way, to live the same kind of life that you had, and you're doing it without this incredibly significant person. You know, I also think after September 11th, there was a lot of we're all in this together, and it felt that way. And I think with COVID-19, we learned early on, everyone's experience is really quite different, and you can't just assume we're all in this together. And I think that's evidenced by the vaccine hesitancy, the anti-vaxxers, the anti-maskers. This has become, while September 11th certainly did become a very political thing, and so it's much more visceral, I think.
You're involved with Calvary Hospital. How did your bereavement program pivot and change to address the pandemic?
So the first thing that we did is we went online. By the first week, we held our groups via conference call, much preferred the virtual platform. And we did that with our adult groups. We did that with our children's groups. And we have more than 30 bereavement support groups. And there are, I think, 7 or 8 of us in the bereavement department. And so the difference between being online with a support group and being in person is when you're in person, there's much more intimacy. You can't deny that. And someone can put a hand on someone else's arm and look at them meaningfully and even hug them at the end of the session. Now we're all sitting in our Hollywood Squares boxes bearing witness to each other's pain. It's exhausting, I'll be perfectly honest, but I also know that it's allowed people to participate in bereavement support groups who wouldn't be able to make it any other way. If they're in Yonkers, but my Death of a Young Spouse partner group meets on Thursdays at 6 o'clock, there's no way they'd be able to make it, but they can make it when we're online. For most of our groups, every single one is full. We created 2 COVID death specific groups, one for people whose parents died, one for people whose spouses or partners died. We also teach an annual bereavement course for nurses and social workers and mental health counselors. And then we had to teach all of them online, which none of us had ever done. And then in 2021, we decided that we would stay virtual. And we went from having 40 students to 140 students.
Oh, my goodness.
But we also appreciated how many more people in professional capacities needed to know about grief and bereavement, to speak to your earlier question.
Explain why it is important to grieve, because there is a stoic attitude out there where you should just keep it to yourself and grieve in private. But grief doesn't really have a timetable, does it? How important is it to go through the grief process?
It is so vitally important. And we've all experienced people saying, you've got to be strong, you've got to suck it up, tough it out, you've got to move on. But that really is disenfranchising our grief. And this concept of disenfranchised grief is when you experience a death or a non-death related loss, and it's not really acknowledged by the rest of society. If a person is, let's say, having an affair, and the person with whom they're having an affair dies, that person can't really say, I really lost this incredibly important person. Oftentimes with celebrities, if a celebrity dies, like with Kobe Bryant, I think that helps change the look of things, and with DMX, where people are actively grieving someone. And so I do think that in some way celebrity death helps bring it out into the culture. But it's important to grieve because these are important emotions that affect us. Grief manifests itself physically, spiritually, behaviorally, intellectually, and emotionally. And a lot of times people will say, I've got a stomachache, I've got a headache, I'm not breathing well, I can't concentrate. Like, that's grief. And if you just blow it off, it's gonna have some other effect on you. Nora McInerney, who's a great writer and personality, has a podcast called Terrible Thanks for Asking. And in one of her books, she refers to this amazing metaphor. If you imagine grief is like a kitchen garbage can, and every week, you throw a little something in the garbage, like some eggshells and some leftover spaghetti, but you're not really ready to take out the garbage. And as time goes on, you're filling it with more rotten vegetables and a TV dinner, and it's just getting bigger and bigger, and you're not taking out the garbage. And then you come in one morning and that garbage bag has exploded all over the kitchen floor.
Oh,
that's what grief is like. Like, you have to take care of it. You have to acknowledge it, because this, I'm not going to get into a lecture about attachment theory, but our attachments are so important, whether it's our romantic attachments or our parental attachments or our friendship attachments. These are the people we have connected to in life, who we depend on. And if that person dies, how can it not affect us? It's just so important that people have some kind of outlet, whether coming to a support group, whether it's talking to an individual therapist, whether it's journaling, whether it's being in nature, but being present with these feelings of loss.
And not escaping them by taking a Xanax to escape it. You're not dealing with it. You're not in the grief. Like, you really have to be before you can move on.
Absolutely. And we spend a lot of time in groups talking about positive coping mechanisms. And you are so right to say people will feel, and this makes me a little crazy and my colleagues as well, if people are feeling kind of depressed or kind of sad because someone has died and they go to the doctor and they'll say someone has died, people like to kind of pathologize and medically treat grief, even though it is a natural human process. The other point I'd love to make, a lot of times when someone dies, the survivor will immediately go to Google and type in, how do I grieve? What is grief? And the first thing that comes up is Dr. Kubler-Ross, who was a fine doctor and a really smart person. And what has happened is those five stages truly came from her interviewing patients who'd received a terminal illness. So the denial, anger, bargaining, depression, acceptance was all coming from people who'd been told they're dying. And somehow those turned into the five stages of grief. So we are grateful to Dr. Kubler-Ross for bringing up the topic and making it something that people know, but it's not the right stuff that they know. So again, I just want to reiterate, it is not a linear process. It's not moving from one stage to another. You can bounce back and forth. You can focus on emotions. You can focus on tasks and your ability to function. But there are so many other theories that truly reflect how we grieve.
And grieving can be very messy and surprising.
Yes.
When it hits you.
Especially triggers. A lot of times people will think, oh, you know, I grieved and I'm done. And then you're watching, I don't know, as an example, Terms of Endearment and those last scenes with Deborah Winger and Shirley MacLaine. And if you've had a parent die, especially a mother, you are sobbing your eyes out. Even if it was 30 years ago, you had a romantic relationship and that person died and you hear a song that you shared. The triggers come from everywhere. And so what we try to do is let people know what those triggers might be. And again, how to deal with them, how to anticipate them, and how to address them.
How do you know what support group might be right for you or bereavement counselor? When my husband passed away 20 years ago, I went to a bereavement counselor, which was, I thought, right for me. But now in retrospect, I think maybe I would have gotten a lot out of a support group, but I guess I was, believe it or not, such a private person. But I thought,
that's more radio personality, Pat.
Well, I don't want to bare my soul to a group. So it was maybe more comfortable for me to be in a one-on-one situation, and it really worked. But I often wonder if it might not have been just as good going to a support group, or maybe even better. How would you suggest somebody choose?
Sure. I think that's a great question. A lot of times when I do intakes with clients, one of the questions that comes up is, have you ever been in a group before? And they'll all say, oh, absolutely not. Because they too are private people. Yes. But then what happens is they come to a couple of sessions, and I always call each new member after their first session, because there is what I like to call an emotional hangover after the first session where everyone is sharing their stories. And the first thing I hear is, I feel so much less alone.
Wow.
I feel less isolated in my grief. And often what happens, with our adults, we work with them up through 18 months after the death. Again, another one of those myths that after a year, rainbows and unicorns come and you're not sad anymore. It's completely untrue. If people come to us 4 months into their grief and they say, everyone in my family, all of my friends want to know why I'm still grieving. They want to know why I haven't gotten over it and moved on. This is a group that understands that and will validate all of that. So I think it's important for people who have a support system who may not understand grief. Megan Devine has written a book called It's Okay That You're Not Okay. She also has a great website, Refuge in Grief. And she talks about accompanying people in grief, that it's not your problem to fix. It's your problem to listen and to just be present. And she's so smart. She's a grief therapist, and her partner drowned a number of years ago. So she gets it. So also with coming to group, I'm a little biased, but if there is a if it's a master's level or above led group as opposed to a peer support group, because a peer support group can be very helpful, but oftentimes it might not cover what everybody wants. The person who's leading it might have an agenda or just want to focus on a couple of things. And for anyone who's been in a group, if you don't have a personality that lets you advocate for yourself, it's a little harder to be, I think, in a peer support group. Also there at Calvary, we organize our group by relationship, with the exception of my young adult bereavement group. That's for anyone. And our children's groups also are not organized by relationship, but as opposed to a general loss group. And people find that so helpful. We even divide our young spouse partner group from our older spouse partner group, because if you are 32 and the person you married had cancer for 18 months of your marriage and you never got to have children, you are having a very different experience, and you're now widowed at 32. You're having a very different experience from someone who's 80, who was married for 60 years and has grandchildren. We are so mindful of what these individual experiences are like. Although you are all in a group together, you are all having a very different experience. And I like to say that when you are in a bereavement support group, you are increasing your capacity for compassion and empathy, and the world can use more people who are compassionate and empathetic.
Hear, hear. Before I forget, I personally was surprised at how the second year was harder for me to navigate than the first year. Do you hear that from people?
I do. And that's because, again, everyone thinks that the first year is the hardest because you go through the first of everything. But you also notice that the rest of the world has moved on. I don't know in your own experience, Pat, of people who even now continue to check in with you about the death of your husband.
Oh, like, no. They've moved on a long time ago.
Yeah, and that's hard. That's really hard for people, especially people who really showed up for you when it first happened.
Yeah. Well, what about kids? I would imagine it's super important for kids to grieve.
Oh, absolutely. And it's so important because children experience grief in very real ways. Even when children are infants, one or two, they recognize the smell of that person is gone, the routine of that person is gone, but they don't obviously possess the vocabulary to express themselves. So they may feel it somatically, like grown-ups do, with headaches and stomach aches. And in our support groups, they come because they need a space to understand what death means, and we explain it in age-appropriate ways. But for instance, we use very concrete terms. Mom died. Not mom passed away, not mom transitioned, not mom is gone. Because children at that age, if they're told mom is gone, want to know when she's coming back. If mom is sleeping, when is she going to wake up? If mom got sick, does that mean that if I get sick, I'm going to die? So we speak in really, really concrete terms. We help them to cope with the emotions they're feeling. We work with them on how to remember their person and how to look forward and think of ways to honor their person as they grow up. So children who've experienced the death have higher rates of depression and anxiety, and they may have difficulties in school. And what family members and educators may see as acting out, in quotation marks, is quite often their grief having nowhere to go. The other thing to know is that children oscillate between feeling what they're feeling and then going out to play the next minute. And that's totally okay. But making sure that children have an outlet, whether it's talking to their parents and guardians, whether it's talking to a counselor or an educator. We do also a lot of art with the kids, drawing a picture of memories. We talk a lot about memories, and it's really hard with younger children whose parents die when they're two or three, don't have as many memories. We talk about, what have you heard, and what do pictures say, and do you know mom's favorite color? And we try and focus on things like that. We also have a children's bereavement camp that we offer every summer for free to the children who attend our group. And prior to the pandemic, we probably had 80 to 90 kids. The ratio of campers to counselors was 2-to-1. We spent time outside. We did regular recreational activities, and we do a grief activity each morning. And the kids just loved it because they got to see they are not the only kid who doesn't have a parent, a sibling, a grandparent. And the level of laughter is just, everyone just has fun. And they're allowed to be kids for that week. And since the pandemic, we've done it virtually. After 18 months of doing this, it is harder to engage children online because they've been online at school all day. And like grown-ups, if you're online all day, you've got a bit of Zoom fatigue. So we try to be more creative with the things that we do. But I know in my tween group for kids 9 to 12, we still do a lot of talking. And a lot of it is processing a lot of these non-death losses of, you know, if you were supposed to graduate from middle school and you did it online, how does that feel? so important to hear kids. The other thing that's really important is that the adults in their lives model grieving for children. So I know a lot of adults really want to be strong for their children and not let them see them cry. But if your child sees you cry, your child understands it's okay to cry and to be sad and to talk about the person who died. So I really encourage parents and guardians to feel what they're feeling and share that with their kids, you know, not in a dramatic fashion, but just maybe they can create a ritual together. So every evening at 6 p.m., they light a candle and talk about dad and maybe journal together. But it's just nice. Important to be able to process these feelings as a family.
What about Grief Awareness Month? What is Calvary doing to address that?
Grief Awareness Month started just a few years ago. We have put together on our website, which is calvaryhospital.org, some great resources for families. We have an age-appropriate book list. We have podcasts that we recommend. My colleague, Jacqueline Marlowe, wrote a great essay on 10 activities that you can do with children at home with a great explanation, again, of why children need to do that. There's a great meditation from another colleague, Chaplain Yvette. And so it's a great place to also find out about all of our support groups and how to get involved with those. And for donors who want to support the grieving community, it's a good resource for them as well.
Well, you've been fabulous. Is there anything that we didn't talk about or anything that you would like to underline or mention as we start to wrap this up?
So a lot of people have heard about the very stressful sort of end of life that people are experiencing right now, whether it's due to COVID or due to something else, especially if the person is in the hospital. Dr. Ira Byock, who's really a profound thinker on hospice and palliative care, has this theory, this belief that there are four things that matter, really, at end of life. I think he also says in relationships in general, but for this purpose at end of life, to say, I forgive you, and please forgive me, and thank you, and I love you. And this pandemic has really denied people the opportunity to do that. Even if you're doing it via Zoom, it's not the same as being able to touch your person and thank them for everything they've done in life. I think at one point he had another one, which was goodbye. And so when families were not able to be with their people at the hospital and could not say these things, what does that do to their grief? Also, the backlog that funeral directors had because so many people were dying at one time. Yeah. And then being able to have a funeral with 10 people. And that includes perhaps the clergy member and the guys digging the grave. It's surreal. And thank heavens that I know that a lot of funeral homes did virtual services before the pandemic, but now everyone has upped their game. When a person is getting hospice care, the hospice staff, especially the social worker and the volunteers and the spiritual care people, are really good about saying, let's talk about these arrangements. Have you talked about what you want to have happen? And they'll have that conversation with the patient, then they'll have it with the family. And when people are in the hospital during a pandemic, nobody gets to have that conversation. Right. And if you don't know what your person wants, you know, there may be some guilt that you didn't do what they wanted or that you don't know what's important to them. And so people are really being denied the opportunity to ask these important questions. And so I guess if there's anything else I can say, Pat, it's to ask these questions now. Know what is important to your person. Know how they want to say goodbye. You know, advanced care planning, having a health care proxy, like taking away some of the mystery really helps your survivors get through this because they can say, you know, we had this conversation and I'm so glad we did.
Yes.
And so I hope that people can do that because, and here's how we bring it all back. On September 11th, very few people got to say, please forgive me. I forgive you. Thank you. And I love you because life changes in a second. So whether that's the kind of experience we're having or this long pandemic, you need to have those conversations because you might not have a chance again to say, I love you.
Wow, that's a great way to wrap this up, and you were fabulous. Thank you
Thank
so
you.
Much.
Sure.